particularly for fruits, vegetables, dairy, and poultry, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, USDA. Still, many consumers balk at paying the higher prices that typically are attached to organic products. And while there is a lot of research indicating that organic yields may come close to conventional ones, they often fall short of matching production levels achieved with pesticides, making it hard to convince conventional farmers to cast aside their long relied upon weed killers, insecticides, fertilizers, and fungicides. Organic industry advocates say they need more federal, state, and local programs to help support organic research. From 2002 to 2014, the USDA supplied roughly $142 million in research grants to address many components of organic agriculture, such as how to manage weeds adequately to sustain crop yields while protecting and building soil health. But the investments will need to expand to bring organic production in line with consumer demand, organic industry leaders say. An increasing number of environmental and agricultural experts say there is a middle ground, even if producers are not willing to take all the steps required to be considered an organic producer. They still can make changes that lower pesticide exposures and better protect people and the environment. Techniques that reduce the need for pesticides include planting cover crops, rotating different types of crops from season to season, using animal waste to fertilize fields, and creating large buffer zones around fields that offer diverse native plants. The buffer zones attract natural predators, such as birds, that will eat insects harmful to crops, which means farmers can cut down on insecticides. All the strategies help protect and replenish the soil, which is critical to long-term production of nutritious and abundant food supplies. The hallmark of a truly sustainable system is its ability to regenerate itself. When it comes to farming, the key to sustainable agriculture is healthy soil, since this is the foundation for present and future growth, states a report by the Rodale Institute, which encourages and teaches sustainable farming practices. The term agroecology has come to define this effort to turn farming away from the resource-intensive, fossil-fueled, and pesticide-dependent practices tied to mass production of a few select crops, and instead toward a view of agricultural land as precious ecosystems to be protected. Change will mean many things, including more research into agroecological techniques, such as strategies for fighting crop pests and diseases without pesticides, and into the breeding of enhanced varieties of important crops. Change also requires educating farmers about truly sustainable practices, which will be critical for the future of food production as the global population expands. The United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization is among many groups and individuals around the world pushing agroecology initiatives as part of a badly needed turning point in the global food system. To support such efforts, governments must shift subsidies and research funding from agro-industrial monoculture practitioners to small farmers using agroecological methods. There is no time to wait, according to Hilal Elver, who was appointed in 2014 as the United Nations Special Rapporteur, or designated independent expert, tasked with examining food and human rights issues across the globe. As a lawyer, research professor, and co-director of the Project on Global Climate Change, Human Security, and Democracy at the University of California, Santa Barbara, Elver has been among a number of international voices calling for systemic changes in agriculture. Industrialized agriculture is not only failing to feed the world, but also contaminating the environment and poisoning its inhabitants, she and many others assert. Agroecology is a traditional way of using farming methods that are less resource-oriented and which work in harmony with society, Elver said in a speech delivered in Amsterdam in 2014. New research in agroecology allows us to explore more effectively how we can use traditional knowledge to protect people and their environment at the same time. Changing long-standing habits is hard. Some economists who study agricultural sustainability say that moving farmers from a focus on short-term production to long-term conservation would require financial incentives from the government. These types of green payments to farmers who plant crops that are beneficial to the ecosystem have already started in the United States as a way to promote cover crops. The USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service, NRCS, has been deploying teams of farmers/teachers across the country to convince farmers of the benefits of cover crops and to help spread the word that using them could earn a check from the government worth $40 to $60 per acre for up to 3 years. Farmers are told that adding crops such as oats, hay, rye, or buckwheat instead of using a steady rotation of corn and soybeans can enrich the soil substantially. The programs are making some progress but still lack robust government support. NRCS staffers are discouraged, for example, from touting the pesticide reduction benefits that cover crops bring, and telling farmers to cut back on pesticides is frowned upon. Without an overhaul of the current multi-billion dollar government system of farm subsidies, real change will be hard to come by. Since the 1930s, the United States has offered financial support to farmers to help them manage variations in weather, market prices, and other factors, all aimed at ensuring a stable food supply, and such aid to U.S. farmers now amounts to billions of dollars each year through various programs. But support has historically been focused on only a few crops, including corn, soybeans, wheat, cotton, and rice, and usually has been skewed toward helping the largest and most financially secure farm operations, leaving more than half the nation's farmers without any type of farm subsidy. Thanks in part to those subsidies, we have an oversupply of many of these core crops. Take corn, for instance. U.S. government reports show that close to, or well over, a billion bushels of corn are left over from what gets used in America or sold overseas each year. Corn growers, not coincidentally, typically use a variety of high-priced pesticides in their operations that translate to hefty profits for agrochemical companies. There clearly is ample room for a shift in priorities and funding. Greg Stegner, a lifelong Missouri farmer and a resource conservationist from the USDA's NRCS, has made a series of changes on his own 500-acre farm that show the benefits of cover cropping and cutting back on pesticides. He tries to convince other farmers that while more work may be involved in some of the practices, the long-term payoffs are worthwhile. Younger farmers want to listen, while the older ones tend to want to stick with what they know works, he said. Government incentives are confusing and often contradictory, Stegner said, and remain too focused on prioritizing farmers to focus on growing crops such as corn. I've realized our government programs aren't really here to help us farmers much, he said. It's about cheap food for the population and profits for the big corporations. Perhaps most critically, we need immediate, widespread reform of our regulatory system. Transparency at all levels is vital. Corporate influence over regulators must be curtailed, and safety data on pesticide products can no longer be secreted away from the scrutiny of the public and of independent scientists. A responsible government cannot rely on safety testing that is conducted by self-interested corporations, but most support research performed by truly independent academic and government scientists. This work can be funded by a registration tax on each new pesticide that a company wants to bring to market. And when it comes to determining what, if any, safe levels exist for pesticide residues in food, regulators should depend not on corporate-generated science, as they currently do, but on robust independent research that takes into account cumulative exposures people face each day in this pesticide-laden world. The FDA and the USDA should accept the recommendations of the U.S. Government Accountability Office, GAO, and start routinely testing food products for glyphosate residues as long as the weed killer remains widely used on food crops. It is unconscionable that the primary agencies consumers must rely on for food safety guidance have spent decades declining to test for possible contamination of such a pervasive crop chemical. The lack of action is especially egregious considering that the agencies have known for years about research linking glyphosate to cancer and other diseases. And at the very least, U.S. regulators need to let the public know what other common pesticides are used on food but not tested for each year, along with the potential effects of not testing. The GAO recommended as much to the agencies in 2014, but the advice was ignored. The EPA must also start robust evaluations of formulated products rather than focusing safety assessments on single active ingredients. Instead of looking solely at glyphosate, for instance, regulators must give greater consideration to what people are actually exposed to, finished products such as Roundup. And much more research is needed on the cumulative impacts of the range of pesticides people are exposed to regularly. The fact that a single strawberry sample contains residues of more than a dozen different pesticides cannot be brushed aside as inconsequential. It is time for the EPA to make good on its obligation to identify and restrict endocrine-disrupting pesticides to protect people as well as fish and wildlife. The Food Quality Protection Act requires that the EPA screen pesticide chemicals for their potential as endocrine disruptors, extremely damaging hormone-altering chemicals that can cause cancerous tumors, birth defects, and other developmental disorders. But despite the 1996 legal requirement for the EPA to identify and act, the agency has accomplished little in the past two decades plus. The EPA's Office of Inspector General castigated the agency in 2011 for lack of action, but the agency continues to drag its feet on identifying and restricting these dangerous types of pesticides. The precautionary principle should be the guide. It is not always realistic or safe to wait until science is completely settled. When there is evidence of harm, when corporate proclamations conflict with independent experts' views, the protection of people and the planet must take priority. There is no doubt that the pervasive pesticides in our lives come with risks and rewards, and balancing the interests of industry and individuals is a delicate endeavor. But too often regulators have shown a willingness to err on the side of business rather than on the side of caution. That must change. This new path will require a cultural shift in the way we view farming and food production, and it could very likely translate to higher food prices, at least in the near term as conventional farmers shift their practices. But extra pennies for pesticide-free, or at least pesticide-reduced foods, is a small price to pay for healthier food, a healthier environment, reductions in illness and disease, and a brighter future for our children. The damage already accrued to the environment and to individual lives cannot be undone. But the evidence of the dangers of glyphosate and other agrochemicals can no longer be suppressed, can no longer be whitewashed. The time to act is now. Some steps forward are small. Others require a more aggressive stride. But we cannot stand still. Innovation does not happen without the courage to question the current paradigm, said Jonathan Lundgren, the former USDA scientist who left the agency when he felt his scientific findings were being sacrificed for political purposes. If we do not change our behavior, then humans are in trouble. We know what needs to be done to solve these problems that our planet and species are facing. What is lacking is the courage to implement the needed changes. Let's find the courage. Epilogue. Terry McCall doesn't like to talk much about her lawsuit against Monsanto. Even as the litigation slogs forward, as lawyers thumb through millions of documents, studies, memos, and reports, and as expert witnesses prepare their testimonies for the long-winding case that may take years to resolve, McCall is trying to move past her pain. Doing so has been made harder by the fact that she was diagnosed with early-stage breast cancer shortly after losing Jack. She tackled the cancer with aggressive surgery and now considers that fight also part of her past. Still, she has lost weight. The slim blue jeans and soft blouses she favors hang loose on her limbs. Her blue eyes and honey blonde hair still have the brightness of a woman decades younger, but her face has gained shadows of grief that she is not sure will ever be erased. She remains haunted by the final months of Jack's failed struggle to survive. After a tumor on his neck was removed, the wound refused to heal and became infected. The chemotherapy and radiation treatments left him with burns and with a loss of taste, taking away even the enjoyment of his life's work, the fruits of the orchard outside his bedroom window. "I felt like we were the healthiest of people," McCall said. She had never before worried about her food much, but now she does, fearing glyphosate or other types of pesticide residues. And she had never known how fast devastation could descend. "It's just overwhelming when you are going through this," she told me. "It's a horror story to get cancer." After Jack's death, she decided she would buy a horse, learn to ride, anything that was new that might offer a fresh diversion from memories of her life with Jack. She measured out land next to the home for a corral and started daydreaming of the escape that conquering a new skill might bring. Her own cancer diagnosis and treatment, coming even as she still faced stacks of Jack's medical bills, added painful complications to an already excruciating effort to build a new life. To help make ends meet, Terry rented out a garage apartment to a longtime girlfriend and reopened her home to traveling strangers as an occasional bed and breakfast. She encourages her guests to relax on the wide front porch where she and Jack used to sit at the end of long days to talk and stare at the stars. "He loved life. He loved people. He would want me to be happy," she said, leaning back on a floral sofa in the farmhouse front room that is positioned to catch afternoon sunlight. Next to her, a rectangular white pillow is stitched with the words, "Love you forever." "I am trying, I am. I know I had a really good life, and I am thankful I had him for 40 years, she said. "We used to hold hands in bed every night. Who has that?" At Jack's funeral, his son Paul delivered what he called an artistic eulogy, memorializing his father's life and his early death. It was a piercingly personal tribute, but this much can be shared. A cosmic monarch flew south across a desert valley garden, and when had reached the sea, perched upon a man reading the red letters of Luke, a man whose heart wished to speak, a man thinking of every man, a man whose shell was starting to melt. He had answers to a child's question, with the faith of a child and dimpled serenity, a mind spinning in infinity. He had answers. He rode waves, the agrarian waves of Santa Rosa Creek he rode, cultivating foremost faith, then love, then apples, children, joy. He rode a perfect point break in Baja, naked and on a full moon. He rode a pure and unhindered love for a certain woman. He lives on. He lives on. He lives on in that friend some of us have that dares and dreams and speaks their wild mind of love without fear of judgment. He lives on in that creamy comfort of an avocado. He lives on in the post office, friendly exchanges, and anywhere love is practiced. He lives on in the mystic church of many Central Coast hearts and hearts abroad. His spirit lives on in heaven. His thumbprint lives on in the community, and his voice and image live on in the dreams of a son. A cosmic monarch flew south across a desert garden, and when had reached the sea, perched upon a man reaching the red letters of Luke. The man shed his early shell, was transfigured, and began to float away. And being guided by the monarch, ascended into the heavens. And having had a desire to share his heart with us, a phrase was written in the sand. Love each other. This concludes Whitewash, by Carrie Gillum. Narrated by Rachel DeLude. Copyright 2017 by Carrie Gillum. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Island Press Center for Resource Economics and was produced in the year 2018 by Tantor Media Incorporated, a division of Recorded Books, which holds the copyright thereto. Please visit Tantor.com for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.